The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gap, episode 515 for Monday, August 18th, 2014. I am on the
And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. Yes, episode 515, palindromic as it is, and with a rock and roll reference. We are the show that you ask questions, you send in your tips, you send in your cool stuff found. We share your questions, we answer your questions, we ask questions of one another, we share your tips. Occasionally we do a show where we share a bunch of cool stuff found, although that's not happening today. Everything we talk about, we try to make pretty cool. And the goal is for everybody to learn at least three new things in every show. And that includes me and my esteemed co-host. Sponsor for this show today is Barebone Software with BB Edit. You can find out about that at barebones.com. And we'll talk a little bit more about that during the show today. Also, Lynda at lynda.com/MGG gets you 7 days, a free trial of their excellent training videos and materials. So we'll talk a little bit more about that during the show. And lastly, I do have a correction from Gazelle that we'll talk about again, but I had said that Gazelle was extending last week's sponsor mention. I said that Gazelle was extending their period out for 2 months. And that is true as of today. I was a week ahead with that news. So I just wanted to make sure we got that correction. And here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here. In Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
That's right. So did you like that Who reference in the intro there, John?
I'm not really into Who.
Really? I thought you were a Who guy. All right. Well,
No. I don't. I'll have to look at my music library. I never really got into the Who.
Okay. All right. Well, I couldn't let show 515 go without a little reference there. So, Where do we go from here? You know what? Let's just dive into the questions. Let's just do this. Okay. So this question is a very self-serving question from our standpoint, because I'm gonna read Michael's thing here, I think, and then we're gonna talk about this. Michael says, I've been enjoying your show for several years now. Over the past several months, he sent this into MacCast as well, Adam Christensen's MacCast. So he said over the past several months, both of your shows have covered the SSD topic. I finally took the plunge. And firstly, I want to say thank you to all of you. My mid-2010 17-inch MacBook Pro now has an SSD, and your coverage of this topic made it easy. He says, I purchased a Mercury Electra 450 gig SSD and data doubler from OWC. The SSD is a bit overkill for my system, but hopefully the drive will find new life in a NAS someday down the line. Unfortunately, however, in my haste to finally make the purchase, I neglected to think of what I was going to do with that optical drive I would be removing. He goes through and essentially asks how to lay out if he has more data than will fit on the SSD in his current boot drive, which I know a lot of us do. You might be going from, say, a 500 gig drive down to a 250, or a 1 terabyte drive down to a 250, or a 500. The question was, how do you lay out the data on this drive? And he started talking about keeping his home directory somewhere else. My feeling on this is that's actually a really bad idea. And here's why. The SSD is great for two things. One is data transfer speed. It's almost always going to be faster than a rotational drive. Sometimes many, many times faster, often many times faster. But where it's even faster than that by comparison is in its ability to seek out and read and write small files. Because there's no noticeable seek time. You can measure it, but it's much, much, much smaller, orders of magnitude smaller seek time than a rotational drive. So to find a file before you can start reading it is an operation that happens almost instantaneously on an SSD, whereas with a rotational drive, it can take quite some time. Your home directory contains all your tiny little documents. It also contains your library folder, which has all your preference files. and in your library folder is mail. And mail has one separate file for every email, message, and then some. So moving your home directory somewhere else is really one of those things that, I think you're going to miss out on a lot of the benefit of the SSD. But moving your music, your iTunes library, specifically your iPhoto library, those things off to another drive, especially your music library, you're going to notice almost no difference having that on the SSD, because it's you know, the files aren't, you're not jumping from file to file all the time. You're just playing music. And so iTunes is pretty good about that. iPhoto certainly would benefit from being on the SSD, but not so much so that you're going to hate yourself for moving that off. Your iMovie, movies, and all that stuff, same thing, you know, if you don't have room. But I think keeping your home directory in one place, that's always been my feeling on it. But John, one thing we didn't mention last week, because we were so steeped in IPv6, is the fact that you put an SSD into, I think, your Mac Mini as its boot disk. Is that right?
Correct. And yeah, I received the mail.
Yeah. Which drive? Remind me. I know it came through me, and I'm pretty sure I know which model drive it was. It was a review unit sent to us, and it was, remind me again, was that the OCZ one, right?
Yes. So okay. OCZ.
Yep.
And it's a 240 gig.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Which is, I'm just going to tell my story.
Yeah,
so that's a lot smaller than the drive I had in there before. So what I had in there before was a 1 terabyte, I think it was a Toshiba. Pretty sure it's a Toshiba that I got from OWC. And, you know, the price was great. I think it was like less than $100.
Okay.
You know, for a terabyte.
Yeah.
I wasn't using all of it. But so here's what happened, though, is that the 240 had forced me to make a decision, because on my old rotational drive, I had probably about a little over 300 gigs of data. Okay.
Okay.
Now, first I thought, well, you know, there is that whole trick of moving your home directory. So I'm like, you know, maybe I should just, you know, install do the carbon copy cloner thing, and then, put the home directory on an external drive. The more I thought about it, and I talked to you about it, and I'm like, you know, that sounds like a really bad idea for the reasons that you mentioned.
Sure.
You don't get a lot of benefit. So then,
yeah, I mean, you get some. You'll be booting from the SSD, and that in and of itself, right, is actually worth it. But, you know, and the things that I didn't even mention, like Dropbox and all that stuff, all that sort of scouring that those things do happens so much faster on an SSD. So.
Yeah. Well, and the points you brought up. So the thing is, so if you're looking for system performance, the thing is, you know, some of your system files, like, is, you know, the library folder, you know, all of that system level stuff there, you lose that benefit if you put that on the external rotational.
Yeah.
It could certainly do it. Now, people may be asking themselves, how could I tell my system where the home directory is? And I'll just do this quickly, and then,
sure,
and then I'll move on to my strategy here.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you go in users and groups.
In system preferences.
And now I got to authenticate.
Which is good. Keeps you from making silly errors.
And then you're going to see list of users here. So, of course, my primary user is me as an admin. And here's what you do. You right click on the user, or control click, and you'll get something saying advanced options. And there's a number of things there. There's a user ID. Don't touch that. There's a group. Don't touch that. Account name. Don't touch any of this. Now, what you may want to touch, now, login shell. And actually, I changed that recently. I think mine was TCSH, so I changed it to Bash, because Bash is the proper shell to be using. And then the next entry in that is is your home directory. And you can choose a different one if you'd like to. So if you want to do this, that's where you would do it. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought it's kind of a bad idea. And even in that advanced options dialogue, it says in red, warning, changing these settings might damage the account and prevent the user from logging in.
Yeah.
It's in red letters, red capital letters.
Now, you shouldn't, if you're going to do this, you should log in as a separate user, right? And move, because doing this doesn't actually move your home directory. It just tells the system where you want it to look for your home directory. So you probably should be logged out, and then copy your home directory to another location, and then point it, right? I mean, I think that's the I think that's the proper way to do this, right?
You know, I haven't actually done it in a while, but yeah, that sounds reasonable to me.
Right.
You can change it while it's live, and then when you reboot, it'll be looking at the but I didn't want to go there.
Right.
Good. There was my backup
for good
strategy.
Reason. Yeah.
All right. So my tool of choice to do my migration, I used my pal. Our pal, Dave. Well, at least it's my pal. I think you have a different pal, but my pal is Carbon Copy Cloner. Just love it to death. And so I basically did a full, well, no, step one, I had to decide. So the thing is, I tried to copy. So I think what it is I tried to do a carbon copy cloner from the 1 terabyte while it was still in the machine to the SSD in an external enclosure, a USB 2 enclosure.
Okay.
The machine only has USB 2.
Sure.
And then carbon copy cloner said, yeah, you know, there's not enough space to do this. And I'm like, oh, man. So now what? Well, let's find the things that take the most space. And you know, the things that took the most space, or at least the ones that I felt comfortable moving off of this drive and putting on the eventual external drive? Two things. One, and I've done this already, but I you know, kind of made it permanent, was my music library. My music library is about 30 gigs. So that was one thing to reduce the size. And then the two other largest things that I have, Dave, were two of my virtual machine files for Parallels.
I have an XP and a Windows
7 one, and they're both 40 gigs. So 40 plus 40 plus 30. So I had 110 gigs of data that if I could put it somewhere else, that would get me below that would reduce the amount of space taken on the drive and allow Carbon Copy Cloner to happily go on its way. And so that's what I did. So I basically moved all of those to my my NAS.
That's awesome.
The music library I had already done because I'm doing the DLNA thing and stuff like that. But I also moved I don't know if I put them on an external. No, I think I put them on the NAS as well. Because why not? You can do that.
Yeah, totally. That's
perfectly valid.
Yep.
So I did that. And then also Carbon Copy Cloner has a facility that allows you it creates and transfers the recovery partition because you want to do that.
Right.
But, you know, it's an all-in-one tool. So it did all that. And, you know, it's really pretty straightforward. It took time. I think it maybe took an hour or so. I don't know. Because on my system, I have two bottlenecks. So one is I'm only on USB 2. Number two, this Mac Mini only has a SATA 2 interface, whereas the drive that was provided has a SATA 3 interface. So that's...
But I don't.
Bottlenecks.
Well, actually, that drive might go faster than a SATA 2 bus.
I'm pretty sure it's a SATA 3 drive.
Well, no, but, I know it's a SATA 3 drive. The question is, does the drive actually go faster? And I think that's the Vector 150 from OCZ, which is rated at 500 plus megabytes a second, 550 read and 530 write. So yeah, that would be faster than your bus would allow. Did you test the drive with the like Blackmagic or anything?
I tested it with, let me bring it up here. So I tested it with Drive Genius. They have a feature called Drive Bench, which is a Swell utility. And what it does, and I like it because what it does is it does four different tests. So it does a sequential read and a sequential write, which in, you know, especially with rotational drive, you're going to get the best performance. Then they do a random read and random write test, and they do it with different block sizes, so you
okay.
get a pretty good feel.
Yep.
And basically the maximum speeds I saw were approaching the maximum speed of the bus, which I think is, you know, about
270
250 megabytes a second.
Okay.
I'm looking at one of the one of the screens here, and it was approaching about 250 megabytes a second.
Yeah. That's killer.
Faster than the other drive I had.
Yeah.
The other drive was fast for a rotational.
Sure.
It was getting in some cases, you know, high 100 megabytes per second in some cases. But, you know, of course, as you know, was pointed out, the difference here with the different block sizes is much less dramatic than with a rotational drive.
Mm-hmm. And these drives are cheap. No, I think that 240, I think these drives are, you know, selling for 50 cents a gig now, right? That 240 sells for like 120, I think, from... from Vector from OCZ and maybe even from Amazon. I haven't looked, but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, so you can get the 480 from them for $220. That's cheap.
Yeah. Well, the next machine I get, cause right now my bottlenecks, so The MacBook Pro has a SATA 1 bus.
Right.
And the Mac and the Mac Mini here has a SATA 2 bus. So, of course, the next machine I get should have a SATA 3 bus, and it'll also have an SSD.
Yeah, from the factory. Sure. Yeah, yeah. But as far as upgrading an old machine, I mean, yes, this drive can go faster than your Mac can, but you're seeing a nice little boost there for what I think is short money. Yeah.
And, you know, just some benchmarks here. So the old drive, the old rotational drive, it took my system the time to boot from hearing the chime to when it, well, I'll say settles down when I see the disk activity go to almost zero, which means that it's finally loaded everything.
Yeah.
Because when you get the desktop, your system's still not quite done doing
still
everything.
Cranking. Yeah, that's right.
Right. So and my mechanical drive, it basically took about 2 minutes, 35 seconds to
boot. Okay.
The SSD in the USB enclosure took 1 minute, 52 seconds. And then inside of my machine on the ATA bus, boot took 1 minute, 14 seconds.
Yeah.
Much better.
Much better.
Everything's a lot snappier, obviously. Yeah. So,
do you notice, as I have, do you notice your CPU like totally maxed out when you're booting up now? Watch that really? Next time, because that was one thing I noticed.
Hold on. Let me try that.
Yeah. Well, hey, whoa. maybe wait till later. all right. Well, that's cool. All right. I want to,
so I think the best strat, but I think the best strategy for everybody is, and you know, I think I even did run, Omni Disk Sweeper. So if you have
clean
to make a decision
up.
Like I did, Omni Disk Sweeper, is one tool that's great for finding the largest files or directories or candidates for things that you can move off of that you may not want to put on the SSD because they're either too big or just really doesn't make sense. So
sweet. I'll put that in the show notes. I did put a tutorial that Brian Monroe in the chat room here. I'll say hello to everybody at MacGeekGab.com/stream. Thank you for joining us today. I put a link in the show notes for how to relocate your Mac's home folder too that Brian found. So this is good stuff. I like it. It's fun. Before we go on to Don's question, I want to talk about our first sponsor, which is Lynda at lynda.com/mgg. What Lynda does is they provide new fresh, well, I mean, they've got new courses out at every day, but they provide thousands of courses created and taught by experts on all kinds of topics, you know, software, web development, photography, graphic design, business. I did find a course. Thanks to a Mac Geekab listener. Actually, I didn't even have to search, which was great. I mentioned Lynda in the last show that I needed to learn how to use regex. And sure enough, one of you pointed out a course on regular expressions right there in Lynda. I started watching. I have not finished. I had to do this show today, and yesterday was Lisa's birthday, so it's been a little bit nuts here. But that's how I'm going to learn regular expressions, and I will report back on my findings because I have no doubt that this is going to teach this to me. These videos, they're super high quality, super easy to follow, and the cool part is that they're so well done. I mean, it's not like, you know, just some dude on YouTube. And don't get me wrong, there's some dudes on YouTube that can teach you things, but most of the time it doesn't look all that good, and oftentimes the information isn't all that good either. But these Lynda videos, they're professionally produced. They've got courses for all experience levels, and they've got them broken out ahead of time for you so you know exactly what you're getting into. They have mobile apps so you can stream the courses right to your iPhone or iPad, which is really cool if you're trying to learn something on the computer, like to do on the computer. Put your iPad next to the computer, stream the course there, and then you can pause the course and try something out on the computer and then go back and forth. The courses are broken up into chapters, and you can have it so that it just, when one chapter finishes, goes right to the next, or you can set it to stop at the end of the chapter so you can tinker around a little bit, do whatever you're doing, and then you know, move on to the next one. So they've really, not only do they create these awesome courses, they've really perfected and continue to work on. It's certainly not something they stand still with, but they have perfected this learning environment that they put you in. And the courses are sort of the foundation of that, but it's not all that it is. There's far more. They've got searchable transcripts and you can build playlists. And you even, when you finish a course, you get a certificate and you can publish that to your LinkedIn profile, which, you know, these courses from Linda, they're respected. So, you know, people are going to see these and say, hey, you know, this person, they know their stuff just simply because you've got this transcript. In fact, 30% of colleges and universities and most Ivy League schools offer lynda.com subscriptions to students and faculty members. So if that's not a testament to how good this stuff actually is, I don't know what is. You know, I mentioned the RegEx course, some courses that might interest you here just because you're listening to this show. iOS App Development Essential Training, iPhoto 11 Essential Training, Up and Running with Apple Remote Desktop. They've got all kinds of things for, I mean, you can hear just from those examples, super geeky stuff. If you want to learn RegEx, iPhoto 11 Essential Training for getting your feet wet and making sure you're not missing out on some of the best features in the software that you use every day. So check it out. Lynda.com, LYNDA.com/MGG. That /MGG is important for a couple of reasons. First of all, it gets you your 7-day free trial, but it also lets them know that you came from us. And obviously that's a good thing for all of us too. So LYNDA.com/MGG. I'd appreciate it if you check it out. I know John would appreciate it. And I think you'll appreciate checking it out. And hey, 7 days for free. That's a good thing, right? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
A couple more things, Dave.
Go.
Regarding SSD.
So okay. Well, okay. I wasn't sure if we were done with the sponsor thing, if you were where you were bringing us. So, lynda.com/MGG. So go ahead, John. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you, Linda. So I also got Trim Enabler.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep.
And here's some of the interesting observations. Well, one, putting this in a Mac Mini, the Mac Mini is a challenging machine to replace the hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like some Apple machines that you can't just pop it out. Actually, on this Mac Mini, you actually have to slide the CPU board back.
Okay.
So you can have enough space to pull out the SSD and then replace it. And also, you got to be careful because there's a temperature sensor that is that adheres to the drive.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what,
you get that right on this machine. Now,
if you don't put that back, that's when you run into the problems I originally had with this machine when I swapped out the SSD. Yeah.
The iMac has a similar thing. Yep. Yeah. So that,
yep.
I think if it doesn't see, and I think it's just a little resistor called a RTD or something like that. It's an electronic component that measures temperature, but if it's not there or present,
your fans run all the time.
I think it assumes that the temperature is the maximum value.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes nuts and it cranks the fans because it believes that the machine is about to melt down.
If you run into that, there is an app that you can run. And I'm trying to remember the name of it. There were a couple. I'm not running it anymore because I don't need to because I took this thing apart and fixed it. But what was it called? It's not SMC Fan Control. I'll put a link in the show notes again. I'll find it from a previous show, but there.
Oh, I got one, Dave.
Oh, you do?
Because okay. I do have a temperature related thing. So the one thing I noticed, so it seems Trim Enabler, I was able to run it and install it and it's running and it's not pestering me for money. Which is nice.
Right. Good. Yeah.
I think they do if you want extra features, but I believe the core functionality I'll throw some money anyways.
Sure.
But it has a screen and it shows temperature null. So apparently this drive doesn't report its temperature. I don't know.
Okay.
But what I did notice is once I installed this, Dave, now you and I both upgraded to the latest iStat menus.
Yes.
And one thing I noticed, Dave, is looking at the various sensors. So it shows the HDD sensor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it shows that I got it right and I didn't screw that up. But it showed one of my temperatures red. It showed my CPU heatsink at 155 degrees Fahrenheit, and that turns it red. And I'm like,
Okay.
That's not good. So speaking of fan control, iStat menus lets you set the fan control. So I think by default, the exhaust fan on this runs at 1800 RPMs. And when it was running at the default speed, one of my sensors was indicating it was too hot. I kicked it up to 2000 RPMs, and it is now at a temperature that is not red.
So iStat menus, and this is true whether you're running version 4 or version 5, it's had this for a while, will let you set the minimum fan speed. And it lets you have profiles, so you could have different profiles. Like, I know I'm going to be doing video editing or something, so I want to set them a little higher to get ahead of it or whatever. It lets you set your minimum fan speed. But if you're having a problem, like I was with the drive sensor not being there and the drive thinking that it's hot and the fans need to run at full tilt, you cannot slow the fans down below the minimum speed that the system deems they should be running at with iStat menus. But there is other software that will, instead of reading the temperature sensor that's on the drive, it'll read it via smart and then adjust the fans accordingly. And that's what I was using. So,
right. So, yeah. So my only conclusion is that with this drive in here, the drive may be running hotter than the drive that it came with.
Yep.
And it's kicking that one, or for whatever reason, the CPU is just working a little harder, but it only nudged one thing in to make it red. I mean, the machine still works, but I wasn't comfortable with it being red.
Yeah.
So I just bumped up the fan speed and now I'm happy. So just something to keep in mind if you do upgrade to an SSD or upgrade anything in your computer, you may change the thermal dynamics. How do you like that?
I like that. That's actually, that makes
you should
me
address
really
it accordingly, because we have had people write in saying, you know, if you run too hot, you can potentially damage your machine, or you know, have to deal with the fans running at like airplane speeds.
Yeah, right. So I found two. One is, the one that I was running was HDD fan control, which is from Ben Surtees at Surtees Studios. He makes a bunch of other shareware. That's not free. You do get to try it for free, and he encourages that you try it for free for an hour to make sure it's going to work with whatever you've got going on with your system. And then there's another one that is free called SSD fan control. And I actually tried both of them and they both worked fine. I wound up using Ben's, just cause I know Ben as a developer and I trust him. So, you know, go figure. So I also had bought it. And so, you know, once you buy something, you want to support it. So there you go. But now I don't need it anymore, cause I put the sensor in the right spot when I took it apart again and again and again and again and again. So you're happy with the SSD? How much, I meant that to be a question. Are you happy with the SSD, and how much space do you have available on it now that you've sort of migrated everything to where it needs to be?
I'm at a comfortable level right now. So if I go to, how can you tell how much space you have available?
Well, I look in the Finder.
And that's what I'm doing right now. So I'm in the Finder, and then you click on more info, and then there will be a storage tab. And so I'm looking right now. So it says, 240 gigs, solid state SATA. And right now I have 39.52 gigabytes free out of 239.06. And that is fine.
I actually, in the Finder, and this is a trick that you may know and you may not, but I'll share it for the benefit of everyone. If you have a Finder window open and you go to the view menu and choose show status bar, it actually shows you your free space available at the bottom of every Finder window. So, which I like. I like it at a glance.
You know, I think I've had to enable that. I think some recent OSs by default turn that off. Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
But on all my machines, I have that. Yeah. So it also shows, 40.2 gigs available. So,
okay. Yeah. Right.
Good stuff. So thank you so much, my friend.
Oh, no. Well, we're progressing things along here. That's all we're doing. So yeah. Thanks to the good folks at OCZ for participating in our kind of long-term experiment here. It's a good thing. So, all right. Let's move on to Don. See if we got a couple of quick questions here before we get into some more crazy stuff. Don writes, on a recent trip to Turkey, I took several hundred photos with my digital camera before noticing that its date was set to 2016 instead of 2014. Is there any way that I can bulk modify all of the creation dates for my photos from June XX 2016 to June XX 2014? I'm happy to buy an app to do this if you so recommend. Great question, Don. And yeah, there's a couple of ways to do this. What you're talking about changing is not the modification date of the file, but an embedded date inside the picture that is part of something that's called EXIF data, EXIF. And John, I'm sure you're going to tell me what EXIF means, right? At some point, maybe. Do you know off the top of your head? I don't.
Something, something interchange format. I don't know.
All right.
But,
oh, sweet.
You're correct, but I'm going to let you spit out yours because I got two, Dave. You got two and I got two.
All right, great.
I'm going to surprise you.
So I did. I found two things. EXIF tool, which is free, is a command line only utility with some instructions on their website. So it's not too bad to do this. But EXIF tool is has a date time shift feature. If you don't, and somebody wrote an automator, some sort of action thing for it. So that's one option, if you want to use that. And then there is a better finder attributes, works to do this too. It will edit the EXIF data in a photo and you can, bulk edit all of that stuff. So. Those are the two I found. Some folks in the chat room are coming up with a couple more, but John, I'll let you go first.
I got two.
I know.
And one of them, Price is Right, Dave.
I like that.
Price is free.
All right.
And what's the application, you may ask? The application is iPhoto.
Seriously?
I am serious,
brother. How did I miss that?
I'm going to surprise. You know, I keep surprising you after all these years.
That's awesome.
So, here's what you do in iPhoto. You go to iPhoto and then you go to the photos section, which you should get a list of your photos. And then you highlight the photos that you would like to change the date on. Here's the path. iPhoto, photos, batch change, date. This is a feature built into iPhoto to change the date on photos.
That's the best answer.
And then a better answer, if you have Aperture. Now, of course, you have to pay for Aperture. I believe the last price I checked was $79. And right. Even though they, you know...
it's end of life, man.
Well, actually, iPhoto and Aperture are both...
That's right.
Apple has clearly stated that they're not going to develop either one of those anymore. They're still usable.
Sure.
And they're still great. And you know, again, iPhoto, the price is right. So... get it while you can. I would even say Aperture. You know, it's not like Aperture is going to stop working because from what I hear, it'll work under Yosemite. It'll run. They'll make sure it runs under Yosemite. Maybe not under future OSs, but as far as I know, Aperture will still run. So it's not like it's dead. Totally dead. It's not going to get on the cart yet.
Right. That's right. I'm not dead yet.
So here's the other section. So in Aperture, very similar. So in Aperture, you go to the photos view, you highlight the photos you'd like to change the date on, and then there is a metadata menu. And part of that, one of the choices there is adjust date and time.
That's awesome.
So there you go. So both of Apple's photo apps let you change the date because that's a common problem.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I don't know if technically that is EXIF data, Dave. It could be. EXIF data, when I hear EXIF, I typically think of data that is more photography specific, like, you know, the shutter speed and the aperture and the ISO and stuff like that. But I guess you could consider the date and time.
I think it is.
And the location included in there as well.
Yeah,
so
right.
All the additional stuff
right.
That's not the photo, I guess. You could make a blanket statement and say that's all EXIF data.
Yep. Yeah, the metadata tags defined in the EXIF stand. Easy for me to say. EXIF standard cover a broad spectrum date and time information, camera settings, thumbnail descriptions, and copyright information. That's from Wikipedia, so it must be true. And according to Wikipedia, which agrees with Doc Rock in the chat room, and we'll use Doc Rock as the definitive source on this, it is the exchangeable image file format. So there you go. That's that. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty good. I like it. Hazel and Lightroom are two other apps that could do this as well. I say this every time, and Paul's a great guy. We love everything at Noodlesoft, but I don't use Hazel enough. I should learn to go there first to do things like this because it's so universally awesome. So we'll put a link to Hazel in the show notes too.
And yeah. Lightroom, of course, is Adobe's photo solution, which they are not abandoning like Apple. And actually, they've been trying to bring people over. And from what I know, I know several of my semi-pro and professional and even not professional photo pals. And Lightroom is certainly a very, very capable program. And unlike Aperture, they update it.
Yeah, right.
Now, the gripe I've heard about Lightroom is that I'm not sure if, I think you can still get a standalone version, but I guess the one fish shake some people have against Adobe now is that they really want you to do this Creative Cloud thing, which is a subscription-based thing. And not everybody's really happy with that model or feels it may be worth it. I mean, I think I saw the other day I was updating, you know, yet again, Adobe Flash Player. And at the end of the whole process said, hey, by the way, would you like Creative Cloud for $9.95 a month?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was only $10 a month and I can get Lightroom? Really?
Yep.
It's like, but you add that up over time. I mean, over, you know, years or decades. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good price. You Photoshop and all that stuff. Yeah. It's pretty good. All right. Let's go on to Chris, John, if you don't mind.
Sure.
All right. Because I think that's interesting. We'll do Chris and then. Well, we'll have a break and then we'll do Mark and then we'll jump around.
Ah, Chris.
Yes.
I guess you'd like me to hit this off.
Yeah.
And sure. I have it in front of me, believe it or not. Okay. Chris says, hi, guys. I'm having issues with my iPhone 5. I returned my last one because it was extremely sluggish and I thought it was faulty hardware. But the replacement one was no better for the first couple of weeks. It seems to be right now, but I would really love to know what is going on. So would we. When it's on a go slow, even swiping between pages on the home screen, the animation is jerky. When using apps such as Facebook, when scrolling, it lags, then catches up. You can be scrolling and suddenly the scrolling jumps the opposite direction or thinks a swipe is a tap and goes. So he's experiencing
sluggish to respond
to, I guess, user input. So it seems to be the theme here.
Yep.
And based on what he said, to me, it's certainly reasonable to assume it could be a hardware problem, but if it's happening on another one, then I'd say the likelihood of that is low.
Very, very low. That's right.
So he said that he did set up this phone, as well as the last one, by restoring from a backup. He has also tried wiping the phone and setting up as new and re-downloading the apps. And he was wondering if the problem is something to do with Spotlight catching up with indexing the data that my 150 apps, I think that may be the problem. He's pulled down from the cloud when I, you don't think so?
Ah, dude, I have way more than that on my phone. I've got zillions.
Well, I'm
going to
give you
apps.
My thoughts because I think,
you know, I think it's good.
Let me wrap it up here.
Go. Yeah.
And he pulled them down from the cloud. And so he's thinking that the spotlight indexing task may be taking too much CPU and that's interfering.
Well, some task is.
That's his theory.
Yeah.
I noticed that, Facebook app. Yeah. A lot of people have problems with that.
It's actually gotten pretty good lately, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think that about wraps it up. So he's getting sluggish performance. He's got an iPhone 5. He's got about 150 apps on there. What's up? How can you tell what's going on? And so you and I both had replies, Dave, and I'll give my view because I think we both have something to add here.
I absolutely agree.
So as I said before, since it happens across devices, I doubt it's a hardware issue. That'd be very unlikely. So therefore, I think it must be an app, Dave. Now, I'm going to expand what I call an app, is that it could be a system process. As he pointed out, it could be Spotlight or a background app or something else taking a processor. And my reflection, Dave, is that sadly, the tools under iOS aren't quite up to par that they really... I would so love to have Activity Monitor on iOS, but we don't have that, Dave. If we did, then maybe we could figure out what the heck is going on here. But we don't have it. But we have things that approach it in functionality.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And so I said, you know, the one utility that I think could give you at least some data to work with here, it's called System Status. And you can get it from www.techet.net/sysstat.
But you need to buy it from the App Store or download it from the App Store, right?
Yes, you do need to purchase this. So this is an app. I don't think it's very expensive. I think it's only a few bucks here. I don't have it in front of me right now. Well, I have the webpage. I'll get the price in a moment here. But the important thing is that what this shows you, David, it's $299 US.
Okay,
so
great.
Come on.
Cheap.
Yeah, and even a thrifty fellow like me actually bought it.
Right.
Because it tells you so much information. And to me, Dave, the key pieces of information that it tells you, which I think he could use to figure out his problem, is that it tells you CPU usage as a percentage.
Right.
The other thing it tells you is all of your running processes. And then so my suggestion, Dave, was adding all of your apps back in one fell swoop. If you do that, you're probably never going to get to the bottom of this. My opinion is that it's probably a problematic app, but if you're not methodical on this, and I realize it'll take time to do this, but if you don't approach this in a strategic way and just put all the apps back, you're never going to figure out which one is causing problems. And I'm convinced there is one or more apps that is causing this problem for them. So my suggestion was, with this utility is add your apps back slowly. And then, use this tool and see if anything has changed. Either, the processes, which it'll list, I believe, the processes as well as how long they've been running. So, you could see if anybody new shows up, but it'll also show the CPU utilization. So at some point he could say, oh, well, I just added, these 10 or 20 apps back, and all of a sudden my CPU is pegged.
Yep.
Okay. Now you have a place to start to diagnose this.
I use an app called System Activity Monitor on iOS. It does similar thing. It shows the kind of a running CPU graph to show, what percentage of the CPU is being used. And then it shows my processes on that same screen ordered by the one that's using the most CPU at the top. It does. Yes.
Good.
It doesn't show, and it's $1.99. I put a link in the show notes. It doesn't show me the percentage used by each app. I think that's information that apps can't get, but they can get the list. So at least it sure seems like that's information apps can't get, because if they could, somebody would be reporting it. But they can show you overall CPU core usage and then the order of apps. So if you see that your CPU is pegged, look at the list, and whatever's at the top, that's probably what's using the most, or it is what's using the most. That's probably what's using the majority of it. And, the way to test that is leave this app running, double tap, go and swipe up on the app that is at the top of the list, and come back and see what's going on here. Now, that's one way to do it. I totally am with you that the best way to do this is one app at a time and sort of,
well, not one, well, but maybe,
yeah, but doing it in chunks and just to figure it out. But before you put any apps on, the first thing you do is when you set up that phone, you're going to sync it with iCloud. And I have seen it. We've talked about it on the show. I've even written articles about it. I've seen where data from iCloud can cause all kinds of problems. My son had put like a big long string. He wanted to be able to text his friend like, ha ha ha, I don't know, 500 times. And so he built this keyboard shortcut in iOS that he would type, I don't know, Timmy, ha ha, or whatever it was. And then it would just paste in 500 of these ha ha ha's, and he could text that to his friend anytime he wanted and like totally fill up his screen or whatever. Turns out
it's not very cool, man.
It turns out that it backfired on him, because once he put that in on his iPhone, every time he pulled up a keyboard, it would either crash the app, because it, when it pulls up the keyboard, it loads all these shortcuts, and it took forever to load it. It would sometimes cause a RAM issue. And at the very least, it was just really slowed for him to be able to start typing. And so we swapped out his iPhone, because we refreshed it, right? We wiped it clean. We started fresh. Same thing. Okay. Must be something with this phone. The geniuses agreed. We swapped it out, came home, and the same thing, right? As soon as it was there, because it was restoring this, the keyboard shortcuts are synced via iCloud. And so what I did was I went in on the Mac, because the Mac, if you sync it with iCloud, gets all the same data that iOS gets. And then you can go into that iCloud folder, the library mobile documents folder, which is your iCloud folder. And I went and I just deleted, I started, I you know what, I was looking at because it was crashing, there were crash logs being stored inside the iPhone, because we had diagnostic data turned on. And so I was able to see that it was like Springboard and keyboard, and that sort of headed us down that path. But don't rule out iCloud data, because there's a lot of settings there that might be migrating to your phone. It might not be an app at all. It might be data, corrupt preference data in iCloud. So there you go. That's my wrap on that. Good?
That's a good wrap.
It is.
What was the other? Yeah, you put the one that I said. What was the one that you mentioned again? The app that you ran?
Oh, I'll put that in the, I put it in the show notes already. It's there. Ah,
there it is.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Okay. It's called System Activity Monitor. All right. So I want to talk about our second sponsor here, if I may, and that is Bare Bones with BB Edit. BB Edit is available at barebones.com. You can also buy it from the Mac App Store, but I highly recommend going to barebones.com, get your free trial there, check it out. And then when you decide to buy, you can either buy it right from Bare Bones. I think you can even buy it kind of inside the app if you've got the trial, or you can go to the Mac App Store if you prefer to do it that way. BB Edit is a fantastic text editor, and it's the kind of thing that seems really geeky. And you might say, oh, I'm not geeky enough to need a text editor. You might not need all the geeky features. I certainly don't. But this thing is built to do so much. The its primary purpose is, yes, when you're programming, it makes things so much easier because it highlights your code. It doesn't change your code. It just highlights the way you see it on the screen. Very subtly, this is created by programmers for them to use, right? So they don't want too much eye candy. They just want the data that makes sense to them. So things are highlighted in sort of a subtle way, but a very easy to see way. When you start a function, it highlights that. It breaks it out nicely. When you start, you can do C++ and you can do HTML, right? You can do JavaScript. All the languages are supported. And I really truly believe that. I have yet to find a language that BB Edit doesn't just automatically recognize and format nicely for you. So, you know, you're building like an ordered list or something in HTML, and it'll actually build the list for you if you want. But even if you open up a file that has one, it's all right there, simple in front of you. It can open and save files from your FTP server. So if you've got like a Dreamhost account or something, you don't have to download the file, edit it, and then upload it. BB Edit actually does that inside. It does it when you hit Command S. It uploads the change to your FTP server, makes it live on the web for you. It's fantastic the way they make this thing work. But I also use it just to manipulate text all day. It's a true text only editor, so it doesn't have any way of formatting text to save it. There's no underlines, there's no bold, there's no none of that stuff. It's just a text editor, which makes it super easy if you need to like sort a list of text, or you need to search through a bunch of text. You can just paste it into BB Edit. I always leave kind of a working BB Edit window open, and it works so well. I go in, I delete whatever I had in there previously. I can sort text. I can find things in text. I can count words. It's always right there at my fingertips. So I highly recommend you can go get a free trial. There's no risk. Go check it out. Barebones.com. Download it, play with it, see how you like it. I'd be shocked if you don't use it and find something that you say, oh, yeah, I get this now. I need this. And it's $50. That's the thing. It used to be hundreds of dollars. They've changed. And now it's $50. So, you know, it's not going to break the bank. And you've got a piece of software that's going to last you a good long time. They keep updating it and adding all kinds of cool things. So check it out. Barebones.com. All right, John, are we moving on to Mark here? Because we promised we would hit this topic, so we got to make sure we hit this AT&T residential gateway thing and just talk through this a little bit at least. Yes?
Oh, go. Yeah, I was looking ahead to the next question, but all yes, right. Let's...
Yeah, well, I want to try and hit both of those.
Not that I have AT&T, but...
No, we've gotten a lot of questions about folks like Mark who have AT&T residential gateways, U-verse, if you will, and... there's a common theme there. These new the router that they give you with this is kind of an all-in-one baked-in device that you can't replace with something that you buy on your own. You can add your own router to it, but it seems like from what we're finding from all of you, we don't have any of these. As John mentioned, he doesn't have it. I don't have it. I'm a Comcast subscriber here. We don't have U-verse. But based on all this back and forth troubleshooting we've done with a lot of you, we've learned a couple of things. And one of the main things that we've learned is that these AT&T gateways, they are routers. Which means if you were to then add, say, a Time Capsule or an Airport Extreme or, you know, Buffalo or Linksys or anything like Nick or whatever, you're going to wind up in a double router situation where you've got a router in your cable modem and then you're plugging in this, you know, your router into it. And that can cause a lot of weirdness because of a lot of what we talked about last week with the way IPv4 works, not IPv6, but IPv4. You're sharing one IP address. So if you're sharing an IP address, if your AT&T device is sharing an IP address, and then it's handing one of those that it shared to with your Airport Extreme, and then that's sharing an IP address, you get into a double routing or a double NAT situation, which is rarely what you want. So in a general sense, the best way we've found to deal with this is to disable the routing in anything you might add to the equation. And that's going to be putting your in the airport, in the Apple world, it's called putting it into bridge mode. I mean, we can call it that everywhere. It might be putting it into access point mode instead of router mode, depending on what your router manufacturer calls that. But you're turning off the routing and just making it an access point, a wireless access point. Maybe if it's a time capsule, it's also a simple NAS device that has it's got a little drive in it that it shares. All that still works. It's just not doing the routing. So that's kind of the gist, I think, of what we've talked about with a lot of you and what we found with a lot of you. So I just wanted to share that here, kind of to fast track that if anybody else runs into it. John, is there anything I'm missing here as part of that AT&T U-verse conversation?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I wish I had some hands-on with it. And, you know, it's funny, Dave, because I'm currently an AT&T customer with a landline through them. And I, for the life of me, I don't think I've ever received any information about U-verse from them.
They might not have it in your area.
No, I'm kidding, of course.
Oh,
no.
Oh, okay.
They constantly pester me. I've had people knock on my door, Dave, going door to door saying, hi, would you... Actually, it was funny. When I first moved into my house a number of years ago, I already got Cablevision because I'm very happy with Opt Online. And like the day I closed on my house, the AT&T people were banging on my door because they knew, because, you know, it's public record. And they're like, hi, would you like you? I'm like, nope, nope, all set. They're like, why not? I'm like, because I'm happy with what I got, man. No, they're very, very persistent in trying to convince me to switch over to U-verse, but I'm just not interested. I get it. I know what it does, but yeah, it's a general issue with, someone running a router that you don't necessarily have full control over. And how do you deal with that?
That you just sort of have to live with it. One thing I will point out, I believe these AT&T devices...
Or maybe get a good text saying, hi, can you put your thing in not router mode?
Yeah.
Let me use mine. And depending on the technician you get, they may either, you know, depending on their script or whatever, they could just say... It all depends, you know. Heck, it's worth a shot to see if they. I mean, it may be technically, you know, off their script.
Yep.
To do that for you, I'm sure it's technically possible to put it in bridge mode and then let you do the router. But
yeah. No, I don't. Yeah, I don't think you can do that. That's what. Again, you and I haven't had hands on with this, but everything I've read and everything I've kind of worked with a lot of you has indicated you can't put it in bridge mode. However,
well, you can't. They could, but they
maybe
don't want to.
Reason. Right. That's it. Yeah. Fair point. That's right. What Michael in the chat room is suggesting is to put your local router in bridge mode and set DMZ from the AT&T router through to your local stuff so that you're passing any traffic through. And then, ooh. Yeah, which could work.
DMZ being demilitarized zone, which is kind of network jargon for like a kind of middle ground between your network and someone else's network.
Yeah.
We'll have to find the technical definition.
DMZ means take all traffic, all incoming traffic that you don't know what to do with. And instead of ignoring it, which is the default for IPv4 routers these days, is say take all this incoming traffic and pass it to that device and then that device will deal with it. So that could work. I mean, you're turning off your sort of def- facto firewall system on the AT&T router, but that's not such a bad idea. One thing I will say about this is you may wind up with a situation where you've got the AT&T router and your aftermarket router on your network and probably in close proximity to each other. The only issue with that is wireless. You don't really want two base stations right on top of each other for the same band. If you've got one in 5 gigahertz mode and one in 2.4, that can be okay. It can be okay. It's not always okay, but it can be. But if you've got two 2.4s, turn off the radio in one of them. You definitely don't want to be fighting each other. And if they're right on top of each other, you will be. So that's another thing to just bear in mind as you head down this path. I don't know that we have a whole lot much more to say on this, John. I just wanted to address it because we've been hearing from so many people about it lately. So, all right. You want to take us to Rob? Because I think this one's kind of fun. I had fun with it.
I think it is. And boy, did I wax poetic here. But yeah. Here we go.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to, I was digging in. I was getting in the, we're going to get dirty here, folks. Okay.
Oh, it's going
to
get geeky. Yeah.
Don't be afraid. And maybe a bit dirty. So anyways, Rob writes, "Dear Geek Gabbers, I set up a NAS drive, a Drobo 5N. It works, but seems to be much, much slower than the Drobo S it replaced. Question one, how do I clock the transfer speeds, both Direct Connect, Ethernet to a Cat 5 network, and Wi-Fi? What should they be?" And we could take a whole episode just with that. Let me continue a bit here. However, maybe my problem resides in how I am backing up. I have three shares, one for my wife's time machine, one to back up my hard drive via carbon copy cloner, and one for a remote hard drive, which will soon be a Plex Media server. Because I back up my computer at work via time machine, I have carbon copy cloner set up at home to back up as a disk image. It takes hours for the Drobo to compare everything on my hard drive than to do the backup, even when direct connected. But this is the way Bombage software advises me to set up.
Which is right, because you're backing up to a disk image, and that's the safe way to do it. That's right.
Right. So that's his first general question. And the second, am I using the best setup to get my hard drive backed up via CCC to the 5N, or is there a better, more efficient way? And he's running OS 10, 10.9. 10.9.4, Carbon Copy Cloner, I assume the latest version, the Drobo 5N, Airport Express, which looks to be the latest, and a MacBook Pro 15-inch late 2011. Cut me off, and we're going to cut him off.
Okay.
So where we're going to start digging here, Dave, is, that's a loaded question. Not so much how do I clock the speeds, but what should they be? So that was his question.
Yeah.
Or at the end of his first question, what should they be? And I'm going to get to a point here where I'm going to help you understand how you could even approximate what you think you should be getting. Of course, you could just measure, but that's no fun.
Well, you can.
The thing is, you're measuring may not be right either. It could be way off. Something could be seriously wrong.
Well, yeah.
How do you know that?
Measuring.
So here's the first.
Yeah, that it's true. Cause we'll talk about it. And I had fun measuring it and then realizing the flaws. I actually realized the flaws in my measuring methodology twice. While answering his question, and finally came up with what I think the right one is, but I'll not pedantically walk you through the two I did wrong and why it was wrong.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. But go ahead. Give us.
I'm going to give you the foundation.
Yeah. Give us some foundation.
Where do you start with what throughput you should be seeing to any drive that you're talking to?
Yep.
And now here's the first part. Not a lot of people may realize this, but you will now that we've told you this. So, there are two speeds that drives typically advertise. The one that they like to tout is the interface speed of the drive, which is typically SATA 1, SATA 2, or SATA 3 in this day and age, though in the past it was SCSI and all that stuff there.
Yeah, that's right.
And they may say, hey, we're a SATA 3 drive. And you could either get a rotational or an SSD that it claims to have a SATA 3 interface. Does that mean you will get SATA 3 speeds, which is 6 gigabits per second? And the answer is absolutely no.
You might.
Not with. I think SSDs may get there.
Well, we just talked about it. Your SSD will hit it.
Well, it's hitting the SATA 2 threshold, not the SATA 3.
No. It's hitting the SATA 2 threshold because that's your max. But
it's limited. Okay, so it may.
No, that drive is rated to hit like 550 on reads. So that's, that's full SATA 3.
All right, so the answer is with an SSD, perhaps. And as they get better and, mm-hmm. and yeah. With a rotational drive, almost certainly not.
Right. yeah, not SATA 3. There's
you will
no
not
way.
Reach the speed of the interface. And so
not with a single drive.
Right. And that's another point that I got to here. So yeah. for example, one of the drives that I have, so, you know, I still love this drive to death. I still think it's a good value. The Momentus XT yep. That I have in my MacBook Pro. And what you want to do is you want to look at the spec sheet for the drive to get an idea of the maximum transfer speed. So, for example, the Momentus XT, which, again, I think is nice for a rotational drive. It's kind of a hybrid. You know, it's kind of SSD-like, but not an SSD. So it says, hey, it's a 6 gigabit per second I/O transfer rate, which is SATA 3. But when you look further in the specification for a drive, it says, oh, by the way, the maximum internal transfer rate is 1.23 gigabits per second.
Sure.
That is the maximum speed you're going to get, even though it has. Now it's good that it has a SATA 3 interface, but the best you're going to get out of that thing, as they say, and they advertise, and some vendors, you got to really dig to find this number. The maximum internal transfer rate is the maximum speed you're going to see out of that drive. That's it.
Yeah. Now, rotational drive vendors tend to obscure that information.
SSD, they just say the interface.
SSD drive vendors, SSD drive vendors tout it because they're able to hit those interface limits, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. Right. And so this totally depends on the drives that you have in there. So that's mm-hmm. item number one. Now, item number two, if you're talking the Drobo or any other NAS that has more than one drive bay and does something RAID-like, which all of the Synology does, QNAP, yeah. All these guys do, you have the potential to implement what I'm going to call data striping.
Which is by default in the Drobo, by the way.
Right. Right. And it's an aspect of any sort of RAID or any sort of advanced drive technology. Or
not all RAIDs. Advanced. It's not an aspect of mirroring, but it's,
correct.
You know, in a three or more drive scenario, it is what will happen. In a two drive scenario, typically they're not striped, certainly not in a Drobo. They're effectively mirrored at that point because you've got fault tolerance. Just because of the way the Drobo works. I think technically they are striped, but the striping effectively becomes a mirror because you need a one drive fault tolerance. And how else would you do that? You know what I mean? Right. Yeah, that's
yes,
all.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So the thing is, for any enclosure that can take multiple drives, there's the potential for you to multiply the performance of a single drive by the number of drives in the unit. So for example here, just to use an example, so say I had one of these drives that I just talked about that has 1.23 gigabits per second, and say I had five of those. Well, potentially, I could reach, if they do data striping and they do it properly, depending on the vendor, I could potentially reach five times 1.23 gigabits per second.
Or with fault tolerance, I think you would reach four times that. I think, but I might be wrong about that. I'm not exactly
right,
sure.
But I'm talking theoretical, and there's theoretical performance, but
still you can increase your performance. That's right.
Right. That's the basic concept for any enclosure that takes more than one drive and does a form of data striping, is you can multiply the raw throughput by that number.
That's right.
So that's item number one, and that's a theoretical value, and, you know, do your math on a sheet here. Now, the second thing, of course, is how does the enclosure talk to the rest of the world? Now, in the case of the Drobo 5N, it has a single, from what I saw in the specs, a single gigabit Ethernet port.
That's right.
So the absolute maximum speed that you're going to be talking to this thing is 1 gigabit per second.
Which is effectively 110 megabytes a second, right? Give or take-ish.
Right. So for an enclosure with a single interface, so for example, the example that I gave here. So for example, you could have the potential for the technology within the enclosure to go faster than the interface it's connected to and talking to the outside world. So that could be a bottleneck.
Yes,
now, there is
sure.
a link aggregation. Like, for example, even my Synology, even the one that I have here, it has two Ethernet ports. Now, my router doesn't support link aggregation, but in theory, because it has 2 gigabit Ethernet ports, in theory, I could get 2 gigabits per second throughput.
If you had the right network hardware. Right. That's right.
If I had the correct router. The thing is, the airport does not support this.
Yeah.
The airport, it doesn't support, I think it's 802.ac or something like that. 802.3. Some 80, It's something, but it's called link aggregation.
Yep.
So that's the other thing. And now you got to look at that. Now you may have gigabit Ethernet. You could have USB 3. You could have Thunderbolt, which, you know, can go, what is latest now? 20 gigabits, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah.
And yep. So, you know, again, to get to the question of what could I see, that's the second point. And, you know, it could be that either one could be a bottleneck. You could either have, you know, doggy drives that are never going to reach the maximum interface speed, or you could have drives that are really fast and they're striped, but the interface is holding you back.
Yeah.
So that was the background I wanted to give, and hopefully he can get the specs to determine this, if you know, his drives are maybe holding him back to what he should see, or it's his interface. And I guess that's the point where and then I guess the third thing I'd mention here is, how can you measure this?
Yeah, because I was today.
Just going to mention, Activity Monitor at a very high level can measure this, either disk throughput or network throughput. Activity Monitor is a tool, but there are probably better ones. And yes, now cool. I will hand it to my friend.
No, I used Activity Monitor until I realized it was the wrong thing to use. Right. Oh. Well, and here's why. So I have a Drobo 5N on my network here, and I have two disk stations at the moment, a 1513 plus and a 214 SE. So the 1513 has five bays in it. The Drobo 5N has five bays in it. I think I've only got, I should know this. Can I pull it up from here? No, I don't have the Drobo software on here. I think I've got four drives in my Drobo 5N for what that's worth. And that may actually be a factor here. So that's worth noting. There's certainly not five drives in it. I believe I have four drives in it. Okay. My 1513 plus, I've got five drives in, and my 214 SE, I have two drives in. So, the first thing I did was, I thought, well, I just need to do some copying of a big file. So I had a 2 gig disk image on, you know, I've got two drives in my iMac, and those of you that are paying attention are going to know what my initial flaw was here. I had, you know, on my 1 terabyte spindle drive, I had a 2 gig file. And so I thought, great, I'll just copy that over to each of these devices and measure it. And I did that. And they both, I did the 5N and the 1513 before I even got to doing it with the 214 SE, with the two bay Synology. I realized, wow, they're both stopping at about 70 megabytes a second. I know I've seen them both go faster than this. And then of course it hit me. I'm dealing with and I was using Activity Monitor to tell me how fast it was transferring data. I'm dealing with a speed limitation of the drive I am copying from. My spindle drive tops out at about 70 megabytes a second. So of course that's what these drives are going to report.
I thought you said you had two drives in this machine, Dave. What is the other drive?
Well, the other is an SSD that I know tops out at like 150.
And you have no control over which drive your files are stored on. Is that correct?
No, of course I do. I don't use a Fusion drive. So,
you don't?
No, but I don't.
If you did, then you'd have no control.
That's correct.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. No. Great. Thank you.
Yeah. So I copied this file to my SSD and then copied to the various drives. To the Drobo 5N, I got 87 megabytes a second. To the disk station, I got 113, which is completely soaking up my gigabit pipe. And the difference between those two may not be a capability difference between the devices. It may be that I have four drives in one and five drives in the other. Bear that in mind. The disk station, the two bay disk station, topped out at about 55 megabytes a second. So that's where that came from. And then I realized, you know, copying.
You said you saturated it at what speed?
113.
Okay. No, I'm sorry to interrupt here, but I just wanted to, because the thing is that we're talking in different units here, and I just want to offer a quick tip here. So some people may be asking, because we're talking about gigabit Ethernet, and that's
that's right.
1 gigabit per second, correct?
That's right. Yep.
What is that in megabytes per second? How could you possibly find this out? Well, I'll tell you how. You go to Safari, and it's using Google search.
Yep.
If you type in 1 GBPS (?)(M), B, very important.
Yes.
You get the units right. And then PS, well, it'll tell you that 1 gigabit per second is 125 megabytes per second.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, with file overhead and all that.
Because to me, that sounded like a low figure, but yeah. So in theory, 125 megabytes per second is the maximum you're going to see on a gigabit pipe, and you got pretty darn close.
I did. Yeah. And I've soaked up the gigabit pipe with this unit before. So I knew that I could do that. Which is great, you know, and I should try link aggregation to see really how fast this thing would go. And I got to put it now. I realize I got to put a fifth drive in the 5N and see how fast that thing can really go. But, you know, I was having this conversation in my head as I'm doing this. I'm thinking, well, there's file IO and, you know, things with the Finder. Whenever I'm testing a drive itself, I use what I mentioned before, Blackmagic Speed Test. It's free from the App Store. It's an awesome speed test app because it doesn't read from anywhere. It just writes data or reads data, but it's a test from RAM to or from whatever device you're testing. So it's much better in that it doesn't involve a second device, like, you know, for me, my local hard drives copying data to or from. So I wasn't sure if it would work over the network, but it totally does. You just point it wherever you want it to go and it's good to go. Speeds came in a little lower with Blackmagic because they do various different types of tests, but not much lower. I got 80 megabytes a second on the Drobo, 100 on the disk station, the 5 disk disk station, and 45 writes. That's reads and writes on the Drobo at 80, and the 5 bay disk station at 100. In the 2 bay disk station, writes were 45 and reads were 60. And that's really the accurate way to do it, because you're ruling out as many thing and you're only dealing with the device that you're trying to test. So, you know, there you go. Those are the speeds I get with 4 drives in the Drobo, 5 drives in the disk station, and 2 drives in a disk station. And they're cheap drives. They're not anything special or fancy. The Drobo actually has the SSD cache, the hot cache there, but the other ones don't. So it's, you know, but that's ballpark what I think would be normal to get based on what I've seen with various NAS units I've tested and all that stuff. So yeah, there you go. Nice. Yeah.
It's hot like red, there.
Like red fishbone. That's right. I mean, listen,
doesn't really exist. That was our confused interpretation of something from the past.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's deep right there. Oh yeah.
The only thing I'll mention is that if you want to make sure your network is operating at peak efficiency, there is this tool that we have used, yeah. Both of us have used, called iPerf.
Yep.
I think you can actually find it at iperf.fr, which I think is very French.
Right? Do they have a Mac build there? I typically use iPerf from the command line, and I think you can get that from there. However, if you don't want to use it from the command line, there is a Java front end version that exists called JPerf. So we'll put a link to both. But I'm glad you go ahead.
You know, as far as the speeds, then the second question, which I think we kind of glossed over, is, you know, am I doing this right? And I think I kind of touched upon it, Dave. You may want to consider your backup strategy in that, does it make sense for you to do a Delta? And I think you may have seen that in my reply to him. I'm like, you got to look at how much time it takes for whatever tool you're using. Does it make sense for you to compare if you need to reach into the past? Because the thing is, it can take quite a bit of horsepower for whatever it is, be it Time Machine or Carbon Copy or whatever, to say what has changed.
Yeah.
And that could be a significant amount of work before it says, oh, one thing has changed.
Right.
Okay. I'll write that out. You want to think about that versus the performance of saying, you know what, just do another snapshot. Just blast it out. Huh. And depending on how often your content changes, I mean, the same with Time Machine.
Right? Yeah, I mean, Time Machine's better at that, though, because it uses FS events to know FS what's events, changed. Yeah.
So it knows. It knows pretty accurately. Okay, this directory changed. So here's the data that I need to do. But it still takes time for it to dig through the database,
yeah,
or you know, the events to find that out.
Yeah,
it may be worth, you know, to use a tool like Carbon Copy Cloner or Super Duper or something to say, you know what, just do a snapshot of this.
Yeah,
and and if you have a high performing enough network, I would argue it may make sense for you to just do that. If
yeah,
you don't need
reading lots
copies.
Of, you know, my tests were to test raw throughput. And so I was either using Blackmagic, which is just, you know, pouring data, or copying a 2 gigabyte file, which is also just pouring data. There's not a lot of disk interaction in terms of let's set up this copy. What file are we doing? Create the file now, pump the data in now, close the file, right? None of that was happening.
Right.
And when you're
that's my point.
Yeah. When you're doing lots of small files, it's not going to be this fast. It's going to be really, really slow. Because it's a, you know, that's the way these NAS drives operate is that they're not really fast when there's tons and tons of little files. No drive is fast other than an SSD, as we talked about at the beginning of the show.
Right. So I guess my question to you, I think I kind of answered it, is, well, try both, you know, depending on your needs. You know, this actually gets deeper, Dave. So I do both, or I do multiple. So for example, my Mac Mini, I do both Time Machine and Carbon Copy Cloner. But when I do Carbon Copy Cloner, I believe I have it set up where I say, just take another snapshot. Don't do any additional work. Don't archive. Don't do anything. Just
right.
Take whatever is there and blast it out to the external drive. So I have a relatively, and I think I set it to run once a week. So I have a relatively fresh copy of the last, you know, stable, hopefully.
Yeah, right.
Right. Version of what was on my internal hard drive.
Yep.
And that works for me. So
yeah, that's good.
I got to add.
That's good. That's good. Hey, I did want to mention, I know I said it in the intro to the show, John, but Gazelle, one of our longtime sponsors, and I mentioned this last week, but I got the date wrong in that I shouldn't have mentioned it last week. The iPhone 6 or whatever it is expected soon, within the next 3 to 4 weeks. The way Gazelle works, you know, you go online and you tell them what you have, and then they send you a box and you ship your stuff back. And you typically have 30 days to do that. Well, with Gazelle this time of year, this year, they are extending that out, and you have until, I believe, October 9th to do this, because they know that they can't yet predict what day this iPhone's going to be released. So you get to go to Gazelle. It's actually October 10th. You get to go to gazelle.com, lock in your pricing right now. And instead of it only being good for 30 days from the day you do it and trying to have to play bingo that way, anything you do from today forward until October 10th, or actually until September 10th, you get until October 10th. After September 10th, you actually get, you know, your 30 days. So I just wanted to make sure everybody knew that starts today, which is Monday, August 18th. So if you have done it prior, based on our mention that you heard last week, go do it again. And that will now reset you and lock you in as it gets closer. And certainly as the new iPhone is announced, a lot of people are going to be pumping their things into this system, and pricing will fall off. So if you're even considering doing it, go do it now at gazelle.com. So I just wanted to mention that, and apologize to everybody for getting that wrong. And I thank listener Kevin for pointing it out to me that it didn't work. So that was good. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. All right. And listener Kevin, you know, he wrote us at feedback@macgeekgab.com. And I think you could do the same.
Did I hear you right, Dave?
Yeah, you did.
Oh my gosh. Wait, that's the band.
It is.
Does that mean we're done?
Well, we're going to have to be soon. We've been an hour and 18 minutes at this point. So
yeah, we have. We have. But again, I believe I heard you say, Dave, feedback@macgeekgab.com.
That's feedback@macgeekgab.com. You're darn right it is. Yeah. No, it's good. And that's where you can send all your stuff. You can also call us at 206-666-GEEK, which is
4-3-3-5. But there's more.
There is more. You know what I want to ask you folks to do today? If you own the Mac Geek Gab app, we've been hearing so many great things from all of you. The work that that Corey and Michael did pulling the new UI together and the whole new workflow for the app has been so well received. I'm getting emails constantly. Both of us are getting emails constantly about all of you who love it. I would love for you all that have sent us emails or that have the app to go to the App Store and write a review of the app. We'd really appreciate it. And if you don't have the app, we'd really appreciate you going buy the app. It's I think it's $4. We've got it in the App Store. So short money. As John said, that's even in the realm that cheapskate like he can afford. Right. And then write a review of the app. Hopefully you like it, but go write a review of the app. We'd really, really appreciate it. I think we have no reviews of the current version and I would love to see that change. I can't write them because, that's how it works. It's got to come from you. So, please go write a review of the app. That's our call out today.
Yeah. A lot of changes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really,
along with that reviews, Dave. You know, yeah. They still help. It still helps grow the community, and it's always worth mentioning. If you go to iTunes, under MacGeekGab, if you haven't reviewed us and said what you love, what you like, maybe what you don't like. But reviews in the App Store, iTunes reviews of the podcast help all of us.
It does. It absolutely does.
Right. It gets us visibility on, it still tickles me, Dave. I got to say, after all these years, to see us in, every now and then we'll pop up on, what's hot in technology. And I'll see us on the iTunes in iTunes. And it's great. It's great for us. And it's great for our community.
It is. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So go right now. I know we've been trying to only ask for one thing each show. But it seems today we're asking for two. So two reviews would be fantastic. Please. And I do want to thank Michael Johnston not only for his work on the MacGeekGab app, which he did a great job with, but also for his work each week taking this show and adding all the chapters and converting it to AAC and all that good stuff for us and for you. Check him out at the iOS Show is his podcast, and also getappler.com. Also, Cashfly Hosting, CACHEFLY.com. That is the place that provides all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. If you need a CDN, please check them out. They're great folks over there. So good.
CDN? What's a CDN?
Content Delivery Network.
Distribution. Oh, delivery. I see.
Barebones.com with BB Edit and Yojimbo. Smile at smilesoftware.com with PDF Pen and Disc Label and all that great text expander. Gazelle, as we mentioned, squarespace.com/MGG. lynda.com/MGG. Drobo, Connected Data, check them all out. Those are our sponsors right now. We love these folks. John, any lasting comments to share? You started the show.
I think so, Dave.
Yeah.
I think I got to say, we love our sponsors because one thing that they do is they don't get caught.
Made up.